It's completely outrageous for somebody running for president of the United States to say, to even imply that there could be violence if he doesn't get his way.
People are going to write books about this either, right? There's going to be a lot of political scholarship on what exactly is happening, but I don't think riots are going to be a part.
One thing I don't want to see, whether I'm running for president or not, we don't expect to have a convention here where people are going to get out in the streets and cause violence. We will not tolerate it.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:10 and it is Friday. It's March 18th, 2016. Good morning. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. We have lots to talk about today. Rick Cini is here from faircompare.com. We're going to give you possibly some decent fares, probably the last of the spring break season if you're planning a trip coming up. We're also going to be talking about tech in Chicago and why the big companies should be paying attention. A couple of big reasons why, and we will talk with one of the authors of a new article about those reasons. That's all ahead on The Opening Bell, but first, from the WGN Market Desk, here's your overnight global market intel. Asian stocks mostly advanced today as higher prices for commodities, including crude oil, pushed Wall Street stocks higher overnight. The futures, that is, shares in Tokyo fell as the yen strength worried investors. Wall Street yesterday finished with a high of about 155 points, almost 156 points, to settle in at 17,481. The S&P at 13.37, up to 2040. The NASDAQ composite up about 11 points to 47.74. Benchmark U.S. crude oil rose slightly to remain over $40 a barrel now. The dollar fell against the yen and flat against the euro. Adobe Systems is reporting better than expected quarterly results and raising its financial targets. Software developer known for Photoshop, Illustrator, Acrobat, and others says it earned $254.3 million in the fiscal first quarter ending March 4th. On a per-share basis, the California-based company says it had a net income of 50 cents. Earnings adjusted for one-time gains and costs were 66 cents per share, and that topped Wall Street expectations. Also yesterday, some big news from automakers. They've announced that there will be a new braking system requirement for all cars by 2022. Here's the head of the National Traffic Safety Highway Administration.
Each of these 20 brands has committed in writing to make automatic emergency braking a standard feature on their new vehicles. Their commitment is to provide this feature on virtually all new cars by 2022 and on heavier trucks and SUVs by 2025.
Those automakers include Ford, General Motors, Honda, Toyota, Nissan, Volkswagen, Kia, and Tesla Motors. A record 17.5 million cars and light trucks were sold in the United States last year. This so-called AEB system is currently an option on many vehicles. It would become standard again on nearly every new car and light-duty truck no later than 2022. Wall Street seems to be doing, at least the futures this morning, seem to be doing decent for this Friday, pointing upward, but still a little weakness there. Dow futures up about 23 points. Europe's having a better night. Asia is also having a better night. Let's bring in Paul Nolte this morning. Paul is a chartered financial analyst at Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. And Paul, now a regular Friday guest for us. Paul, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell again.
Good morning. Nice to be with you again.
I can't see you, but are you smiling this morning?
Well, you know, I was just thinking about it. Ever since we've been doing this now on a regular gig, the market has been significantly higher, so I think we got to keep this thing going.
Well, and the markets yesterday added to that. They've reached a point now where they're doing what the best they've been doing all year, right?
Yeah, we're actually essentially flat. The Dow is up slightly year to date now, and we've seen really a big shift in the market over the last 6 weeks or so. The dollar has come down significantly. We now see oil prices, which were touched $25 a barrel, over 40. We've seen the emerging markets follow suit, and a lot of the commodity prices as a whole have picked up here. So we saw it in the inflation numbers earlier in the week. We're seeing it in a lot of the commodities. So at least temporarily, the fears of deflation may have been put on the back burner, and that's giving investors reason to be buying stocks aggressively.
We want to get into that a little bit more as our discussion continues with Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management this morning. We'll talk about the Fed meeting this week, also the news conference from Janet Yellen and some of what she had to say. That's all coming up on the opening bell. But first, a look at traffic this morning. Here's Mary Vandeville.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Asian stocks mostly advanced overnight as higher prices for commodities, including crude oil, pushed Wall Street higher. But shares in Tokyo fell as the yen strength gave investors the jitters. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 156 points to 17,481 yesterday. The S&P 500 gained 13. The NASDAQ Composite rose 11, but is still down close to 5% this year. Adobe Systems is reporting better-than-expected quarterly results and raising its financial targets. The software developer known for Photoshop, Illustrator, and Adobe Acrobat says it earned $254 million in its fiscal first quarter. Earnings adjusted for one-time gains and costs were 66 cents per share. The Homeland Security Department has formally begun sharing details of new digital threats with private business and other government agencies. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is calling the program If You See Something, Say Something of Cybersecurity. It was adopted last year. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 520. Welcome back to the program. We're on the phone this morning with Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago, where he's a chartered financial analyst, a portfolio manager there. And if you connect with Paul at kingsview.com, you can get his weekly commentary. Paul, I had to laugh at it, this the first line. Before we get into the Fed here in the United States, you wrote about the European monetary system. They used everything from a bazooka to a pea shooter in dealing with interest rates there. They're having a hard time of it, aren't they?
They are, and it's symptomatic of what we've seen with global central banks and interest rates, which we talked about last week, and the fact that interest rates are essentially zero or in many countries negative in an effort to fight deflation and get the overall economy going. We're seeing global economic growth moderate at about 2% or so, and in some countries we are in a recession or toward a recession. And so that is the only lever really that central banks have. There is really at this point no fiscal policy from a lot of governments. It's being really leaned on heavily to the central banks to make things work and start getting things to work. And that's really the only tool that they have.
Here in the United States, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee met this week. They decided to keep interest rates where they're at. Janet Yellen at her news conference afterwards talked about the economy moving forward, but she had a lot of howevers. One big however was whether or not what the pace of interest rates increases, if any, might be. She seemed to suggest they were still on track, but she also seemed concerned a little, didn't she?
They backed away from their four rate hikes this year to two, and that was huge for the markets. And we saw the impact immediately in the stock market, but more interestingly, we saw it in the bond market, where yields have come down fairly dramatically on the 10-year bond, and we saw it, too, in the currency. The dollar has been declining fairly, though it's 1% each of the last 2 days, which really hasn't happened in a few decades. So the dollar has come down in response to a much easier general tone and policy going forward for the Fed. That's a big shift from just December.
Yellen spent almost an hour talking with reporters this week after the meeting, and several of them questioned whether or not the Fed has lost a little bit of credibility in its what you've just described. It's going from four to two and maybe even lower than that. Were you surprised that she was getting questions about credibility?
And that's, I think, been something that's been on the that's been fomenting in the background, if you will, for a while. And I think that the reason behind that is, again, they've shifted policy a fair amount in the last 6 or 7 months. Remember back in August and September, we were all set for a rate hike, and the Fed backed away from that, citing problems in China, problems with the foreign markets going down dramatically. They waited. And then December, they went ahead and moved. They said, you know, we're going to have four rate hikes. Now we're down to 2. So there's a lot of concern about the changes that seem to be indicated by the Fed. But to be fair, the Fed has always said we are going to be data dependent, which leaves the door wide open for the Fed to do really almost anything that they need to or want to, given the data.
So with your discussion about bonds here, is it a safe place to go for investors, or are you still being cautious about sending them in that area?
No, we actually don't mind the bond market at all. It does provide a good offset to the stock market. Certainly, bonds have performed poorer than stocks over the last 6 weeks or so. They've done well, but not nearly as well as the stocks. But bonds did very well versus stocks over the last, or I should say, for the 3 months ending in January or so. So the bonds in a portfolio provide stability and some certainty of modest income now with rates where they are versus the stocks. But again, it's a nice offset to the stock market. We still think rates will not rise significantly from here. So investors, we don't think, will get hurt by being in the bond market.
When people talk about going to the bond market, some often think it's just one little area, but it's sort of as diverse as the stock market, isn't it?
It is. You've got the Treasury market, which is safe and secure, backed by the U.S. government. You will get paid. But then you also have corporate bonds. You have municipal bonds, which are tax-exempt. And then you have high-yield bonds, which have been called junk bonds way back when, but now are high-yield. Those tend to be a lot riskier. There's more risk of default. That market actually tends to act a lot more like stocks and perform along the lines of a stock market. Again, that's part of a market that we tend to shy away from. There's a lot more risks associated with it, but you can get some really equity-like returns in that type of market. So again, very different depending on the risks of default and how they act relative to the stock market.
So if I gave you my paycheck today, where would you put me in your portfolio, in my portfolio?
Well, I mean, a couple of areas that we are looking at are the international markets. We do have some money there that's been helped by the lower dollar, so we do push some money overseas. We still do like the S&P 500, the large U.S. stocks. So even if this rally were to back off here a couple percentage points in the next couple of weeks, we wouldn't be surprised, and we still think the S&P 500 is a good area to be with some international exposure.
We led off the program talking about these standard braking systems that are coming to cars. Are these areas, some of these car companies, possibly good investments?
You know, maybe not the car companies themselves, but certainly a lot of the manufacturers of the OEM products, the original equipment that go into the cars, I think may be a good area to be taking a look at. So there are some niche players there that might be good areas to take a look at as opposed to the manufacturers themselves.
Paul Nolte, Chartered Financial Analyst at Kingsview Asset Management. Again, if you visit Paul at kingsview.com, you can request his weekly commentary, and it really is good ammunition if you are an investor or just an ordinary person with a portfolio and you're concerned. And Paul, we thank you for being with us on The Opening Bell. We'll talk to you again next week.
Absolutely. Enjoy it. Thank you.
Have a great weekend. It's 527. This is 720 WGN, The Opening Bell. Over to the newsroom, Vic Vaughn is standing by with what's coming up in the news. Vic?
Hey, good morning, Steve. We actually have a handful of aldermen in the city who are not too happy with the three finalists that were named yesterday for the job of a Chicago police superintendent. So we'll talk about that coming up. Also, an expressway shooting to go over. All that right after this.
It's 528.
From ABC News, Tech Trends. A more immersive and realistic gaming experience. Virtual reality comes to the PlayStation 4. First introduced last year, Sony's PlayStation VR headset has finally gotten a release date and pricing information. Dana Wallman with the tech blog Engadget has the details.
You'll be able to get it in October, and it starts at $400.
A price point that greatly undercuts the competition, including the Oculus Rift and HTC Vive. There are also a few add-ons not factored into that price.
The PlayStation camera, which normally goes for $60, and the Move controllers, which normally go for $50 a piece.
Wallman says they were likely left out of the bundle because many console owners already have them. As for content, Sony expects by the end of the year, there'll be at least 50 VR games available for the system, including some popular franchises.
Like Assassin's Creed, that's a pretty big game franchise, and that will be available in virtual reality.
And Star Wars Battlefront. With Tech Trends, I'm Karen Chase, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Today, the U.S. government has granted Apple a patent for a new type of encryption, just as the company is battling the FBI in court over encryption in its products. In its application to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, Apple describes a method to encrypt data that makes locks even harder to crack. That's one of the big stories on the tech scene today. Here in Chicago, we've had a pretty good week when it comes to tech and innovation and startups. South by Southwest is wrapping up, and Chicago had a big showing there. And we talked earlier this week, if you were listening to the show, about why big tech companies should be paying attention to Chicago public schools because of the new computer requirement for graduation. This morning, we're going to continue our conversation about this with Christopher Wink, who is a journalist, a co-founder of the company that publishes Technically. And he is with us this morning on the Newsline. Good morning, Christopher. How are you?
So well. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're glad you're with us. So interesting. You were at South by Southwest as well, and Chicago obviously making a good showing there. Park Nav, one of the big winners. Harkin, one of the big winners. What is it about Chicago that the rest of the world needs to know about why we're such a good place for incubating these places?
One of the big lessons we know is every city in the world is talking about what its next generation of business community looks like. And Chicago, as a business leader, is doing the same thing. So some of this is everyone, Tel Aviv, London, Paris, Chicago, everyone is talking about its future, and Chicago is doing the exact same thing. So some of it's the transition, but it's also that this city understands the Chicago-made conversation has to also include next-generation companies on the web and with software.
There's also a little bit of rubber to the road, though. There are so many companies you could go down the list that have been incubated, if that's, is that a word, incubated, that it started here?
Yes, absolutely.
So we do have a track record, and there's something behind that. Is what would you say are the things that are behind that here? Why are we doing so well?
Well, there's a few things. So we know every striving entrepreneurial ecosystem has a university network that has talent, that has an existing business community that can either spin off talent itself or be potential acquirers. And obviously Chicago has real strengths there. We know also, though, that when we're looking at where the smartest talent of today wants to be, they're clustering in cities people want to be in. So a lot of it's the stuff that we just know that's working for Chicago as it thinks about its future. It's just it's able to cluster talent. That really is the answer, that we're finding great centers of intelligence. The same thing that's happened for hundreds of years is happening again now. It's a city that's working, and so it can attract the most competitive types of talent in an era where they can live and work and build companies anywhere.
And those heavyweights, I mean, it's not just one university either. It's some of the big ones, Northwestern, University of Chicago, the Illinois Institute of Technology, the University of Illinois. And then we have Purdue just, you know, within miles of here.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then there's 1871. There are groups like 1871 and these other incubators that are making a huge dent in this. Why is it that the rest of the world doesn't seem to know? Is it that we're not bragging enough about Chicago?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Yeah, I mean, a tech nexus, you know, so we organized this Tomorrow Tour. Us, technically a local tech news site, visited seven entrepreneurship communities over the last month, Chicago being one of them. And Waylon Wong, a former Tribune reporter who spoke at the event, now organizes the Distance podcast, joked that there's the good old fashioned coastal bias that maybe just there's simply isn't as many embedded national tech reporters hanging out in Chicago. And so they just simply don't realize that this existing business community now also has a technology community and a scalable entrepreneurship community. Some of it might be that, but I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact that that no one is going to be or is likely actually creating the next Silicon Valley, which sometimes comes up in these conversations. Instead, we're just building a next generation, a business community generally. And it might be that we're not even quite sure what's happening. And so some good old fashioned coastal bias, being someone who's come from Philadelphia, And I can absolutely raise the hand and say it's a real thing. Maybe we forget that Chicago has all of the pieces that make up a great community, including the 1871s and the tech nexuses and the universities and the big companies like CleverSafe, like Exit for a Billion for IBM. Those things are what make up a great next generation community. And it's here, but it's also something that people are talking about in every city around the world. And we have to remember that, that we're just being the best version of ourselves.
And one of the other things in talking with some of the tech leaders in our community is that the thing that makes them proud to be here is that we are just sort of down to earth. We're not Silicon Valley. We're not too sure of ourselves. We're not bragging. And also the diversity of our community is important. We had this discussion earlier about the diversity of our schools and this new computer requirement and how that might be a lesson Silicon Valley can learn from and corporate America could learn from. How big is the diversity issue?
It's huge. I mean, we know that the technology traditionally in the last 35 years has heavily skewed both racially and gender to white male technologists, and it's also informed in founders. But we know that innovation happens at the intersection of various communities, both demographically, but that also can mean by industry. So if we want to talk about the kinds of future that can companies that can change in the future, that has to include the idea of different kinds of people. It also includes age. We talk a lot about this in the last 10 years. Our next wave of web companies have really been started with some kind of a degree of bias toward a younger audience. So we know that baby boomers are retiring, that there's a huge health and services sector of new kinds of companies that need to exist. And that's absolutely right. Chicago, because it's a vibrant city, and cities always have at their best been incredibly inclusive. Chicago has some of that. We have to fight for more, though. It's so cultural and subtle. We need a wide array of founders and technologists who work for those companies because we need to build the next generation of companies that aren't just the next taxi hailing app again, or, you know, we need new ideas hungrily. And Chicago does, because of being a great city, have that kind of diversity. We just need to make sure it looks like it in all of our technology conversations, too.
We have just about a minute or so left, but you were at South by Southwest. There were several more companies from Chicago who were pitching their ideas. What might be on the horizon after you've seen some of these presentations?
Yeah, we had a company like Review Trackers, both at the Tomorrow Tour event. We've been to Chicago Made, South by Southwest event, certainly included them. Review Trackers is a company that helps it's a startup that helps companies aggregate their online reviews, places like Yelp and Facebook, so they can see in a single dashboard and understand what people are saying about them online. Review Trackers is a perfect example of straightforward, helpful company that's going to support what other companies need too. We're going to see companies like that come out left and right. And through efforts like Chicago Made at South by Southwest can be really important. It's funny when you're in Austin, if you go to South by today, it's something that's happened for years, but it certainly only grows, is each regional economic development group is bringing together, aggregating its next generation companies and talent into one place. So you saw the Choose ATL House from Atlanta and the Chicago Made House for Chicago and the We DC House for Washington, D.C., and groups from places like, you know, Philadelphia and Denver, and contingents of people trying to say we are what can be next for our city. And if Chicago sees itself, which it rightly is, one of those great next hubs, it has to be there too, so it can attract and retain the great talent it has and will have in the future.
Christopher Wink is a tech journalist, also the co-founder of Technically. You can find that online at technical.ly and follow Christopher at Christopher Wink. Christopher, good of you to be with us in the opening bell. Will you come back?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Great. We'd love to have you back. It's 5:46. This is the opening bell. Time for traffic. Here's Mary Vandeville.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:50 on the markets this morning. The futures pointing toward a higher open on Wall Street. The Dow futures up 44 points. The S&P and NASDAQ futures up as well. Futures for gold and silver trading mixed, silver higher, crude oil trading higher. More on the commodities now. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, and thank you, Steve. What a day on Wall Street yesterday. Good to see the Dow Industrial Average into positive territory for the first time this year, and the S&P 500 just short of the 2016 positive territory, and oil went up to $40 a barrel yesterday. How did all of this impact the commodity market? Didn't have much of an impact at all. The grain market yesterday saw wheat futures fall to their lowest level in nearly 2 weeks. And the main reason for that, a weather forecast predicted that temperatures in the winter wheat country of the plains would not be as cold as previously thought, and that would help the wheat crop. Soybeans hit a 3.5-month high, briefly broke through the important $9 a bushel level. But then farmers decided to sell the rally and it backed away. Corn pretty much unchanged, just fractionally changes yesterday. So it was a red screen for wheat and corn and a green screen for soybeans that at one point traded up to 9 cents higher. Head for Sublette, Illinois this weekend. Max Armstrong will be there because there are old tractors there, but 9 buildings of farm toys. You have a nice weekend. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. 9 buildings of farm toys. Wow. Well, if you're planning some summer travel or spring travel, you're running out of time to find some deals. Rick Cini is the founder and CEO of FairCompare.com in Dallas, at Rick Cini on Twitter. He's with us in the opening bell this morning. Rick, if we've been procrastinating on getting these tickets, are we out of luck? Ticket prices are really going up.
Yeah, this is sort of normal for the pattern now. Procrastinators are going to get hit. I would just note that if you continue to procrastinate, even on tickets you're buying in April, May, even in early June right now, just add about $3 or $4 to your virtual airline ticket every day you procrastinate. You procrastinate 30 days, it adds up pretty quickly. With prices going up across the country, it's just sort of normal as demand hits. You have sort of right after St. Patrick's, you have another sort of break point in prices where they go up in mid-May and also one on June 10th. So they continue to escalate for departures up until June, and then they're expensive up until the last week in August.
Some of these tickets are 73% higher than they were just a few weeks ago, aren't they?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And a lot of that has to do with the cities that you're looking at. So different cities can be wildly different in pricing. That's why it's important if you're pretty flexible. I mean, if you have to go to Disney, for example, you're not very flexible. But if you can be flexible, you can find a deal out there.
And so what are the best cities? Let's say we did want to take a weekend getaway. Where would be one of the cities that we'd find a deal to go to?
Well, I'll give you a few examples. Like right now out of Chicago, some deals that we haven't seen in the past in the Northwest for April and May, which can be very nice there, depending on the weather there. Seattle and Portland for $217 round trip, pretty good deal. Also, you have Southern California, Los Angeles, and San Diego on some low-cost airlines, one of them under $120. If you go to a legacy airline, it's up to $180. Still a pretty good deal out of Chicago. And sort of the same thing to Orlando and Miami in mid-April. You're looking at prices right in the 150 range round trip. And then if you're going out to the East Coast, Boston, New York, under $160 round trip.
And if some of us are thinking of maybe going overseas for the summer or the fall, is that going to be out of our price range?
Yeah, not really, actually. Well, it's expensive if you want to go to London, Paris, and Rome, the three most expensive cities. But there are countries like Ireland, if you're going to Dublin, Spain, actually, Madrid and Barcelona, pretty cheap. You also have Germany, the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, all the fuel surcharges are down a bit, and so the prices have dropped. And plus, a dollar is so strong in Europe right now. All your activities, if you're going to fly within the country or take a train, hotels and all that are really inexpensive. In fact, I just ended up booking our family trip to Europe as well. So that you should be starting to look for those summertime trips to Europe as well.
And if we're those procrastinators that have waited too long to get a ticket, when are we going to see another time and we'll maybe be able to find discount travel?
Well, if you're really looking for super cheap stuff, you can do low-cost airlines almost any time if you're willing to do that. If not, you're going to be looking at the late August timeframe when kids go back to school. That's when the prices drop dramatically, both in the U.S. as well as flying internationally as well.
Rick, I know you're monitoring what's going on in Congress. So we had on the show yesterday the folks talking about this, the Fees Act, the ban ridiculously outrageous, whatever that's called. But what do you think the chances of that is going forward?
You know, I've been watching this for almost a decade now. We're about to have our 10th year anniversary, and I've seen senators and congressional folks grab the mic and say they're going to pass a passenger bill of rights and, you know, stick it to airlines. I haven't seen anything or legislation that even had a chance. We did have a passenger bill of rights that went through New York and then was repealed later on just in the state of New York. In Europe, they have a passenger bill of rights with some of these things. I just don't expect this to get much play. It does get you in front of the camera if you're in Congress, but it's not going to play very well as far as getting actual policy approved and signed by the President of the United States.
Your insight over that time is very important. What is it that's stopping this from happening?
I just think that there's a lot of other things that people are trying to get through. Certainly gridlock in Congress is part of it. We've seen trying to increase TSA fees. We've seen trying to increase airport fees. They're not trying to remove taxes. They're trying to basically stick it to airlines. You know, every time a senator gets charged a bag fee, we see new legislation to either get rid of bag fees or tax it.
Are the lobbyists that are working on behalf of the airlines, is this
absolutely
pretty strong?
Yeah, no, it's part of it as well. The airlines are complaining right now because even on a $220 domestic ticket, about 20% of that ticket's in taxes and fees. It has nothing to do with the airlines, and in theory, they're getting blamed for it.
We've talked about this several times in the past, the record profits, they're making money hand over fist. At some point, is there going to be a breaking point on this?
I think we're close to it right now, right? We've seen prices sort of, you know, the four things that drive the price of a ticket are supply, demand, competition, and fuel prices. Certainly fuel prices are down low. Competition is greatly reduced with four huge mega mergers in the last half decade or so. So really the only thing that's actually keeping prices low is consumers' wallets right now. The economy's been tepid, GDP's tepid, and right now we have good demand on airlines because they haven't added any new aircraft or any new seats into the system. And until we see better competition and added seats, I don't expect ticket prices to go up much wildly, much higher. At this point, it would be flying only for the rich, which I don't think is going to happen.
Rick, safe travels, happy flying.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Steve.
Rick Cini, the founder of faircompare.com. You can find him at Rick Cini and at faircompare. That's the opening bell for this Friday. We hope you'll be back bright and early with us Monday morning at 5 o'clock here on WGN. Thanks to our producer, Mary Sandberg. Production help from Ross Cochran, our engineer this morning, Ben Cortez. Steve Cochran is next. It's 5:58.